been the amount of RF energy through the filter than was recommended by the manufacturer. The way the ferrite saturated made a performance response that was very nonlinear. It went into a kind of a chaotic behavior. And the resultant frequencies you got out, the modulation you got out, was thoroughly unrelated to the RF energy going in. As you change the power level of the signal going into the Yig filter, the rate at which the modulated output happened changed. I'm wondering if something similar is happening here. When iron materials saturate in the presence of an AC signal or an RF signal, you get some peculiar nonlinearities taking place. I wonder if you've ever heard anything along these lines, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I mean, it's a lot of this stuff is so well known. Discontinuity. In other words, it's either saturating and resetting, and what's happening is you have the rate at which something is set, is saturating and resetting, plus the original frequency going in, and harmonics. So when you add all these products all together, yes, they're going to be all over the place. You know, all kinds of interesting things happening. But pretty much what's really happening there is that the if you add all of the losses in the magnetic materials and all the products and you put them all back together and their different bandwidths and spectrum and time, it all comes back to the power in. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a question. By looking on the schematic that you have, you see DC. You have a 21 megahertz, actually, so 21 megahertz for the second coil. And for the third coil, which is the output coil, you have 400 hertz. I wonder how, what is the relation, Dick?
I think there is no relation. Yeah, let me repeat that one for you, Glenn. You got coil number one, 0.5 Tesla DC, it says. We've got current flowing through coil number one on this ferrite rod. Right alongside of it is coil number two. Some significant amount of power at 21 megacycles is going in.
10 millitesla.
10 milliliter Tesla. I'm not familiar with that, that system of units.
Is that millitesla, Wesley?
It's correct.
And then the third coil is the output coil, and the output is at 400 hertz. Certainly very unrelated to everything else. It sounds to me like some form of saturation and reset operation is taking place cyclically, a little bit similar to the choatic, chaotic behavior that I've seen in the past. And I'm guessing that minor changes to the current flowing through the DC coil or the amplitude of the signal going into the 21 megacycle coil, I'm guessing changing either of those would change the frequency of the 400 hertz output.
Read what is beneath that drawing.
Yeah, I haven't read the words yet, but if you change either of the inputs, does the 400 hertz output change in any way? Wesley, go ahead.
Yes. Exactly, the frequency that is recommended is 21.4 for permeability of 2000 of the ferrite with the unspecified soft iron U-shape. That's what actually is from other guys that were experimenting with it. Of course, this is a patent and it's protected with the patent, right? But just for the purpose of verifying that, I'm not violating any rights. Back to you.
Well, you too, TTT.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, Dick, I don't want to belabor it, but the point I made up earlier, or brought up earlier, is look at 97.205 when you get a chance. Let's go back to the current subject.
Okay, we'll do that. So, you've heard of chaotic behavior of simultaneous AC and DC in magnetic materials that are going into partial saturation. You've heard of that chaotic chaotic operation, Glenn? Is that what you're saying?
Well, what's happening is, you know, the ferrite itself, when you go above, you know, very, very low levels of flux, they're going to saturate. So you need the iron to get the DC offset. So basically that's what's happening. He's already got a BH curve that's got a slant to it, and he's able to build up to 2,000 Gauss level. So, you know, here's, you know, this thing sitting at a DC offset. Now he's mixing some signals into it. And basically what he's doing is winding up with a product signal on the output. Here again, nothing sounds like super spectacular here, but I would imagine that all of the above equates back to law. I think it's just my feeling, I mean, with working with ferrites and transformers and coupling, is that with this sort of thing, measuring power at different frequencies is not an easy game. In other words, how are these power measurements being made? In other words, I know all the difficulty I go through with, you know, measuring, you know, just even AC power correctly with power factor and harmonics and adding up all the content there. And then when you start talking about frequencies that are going across the board over here, I think that a lot of attention has to be, you know, has to go back to power measurement. Follow what I'm saying, Dick?
Dick, will you have on the need of it, if you can read that, which says that what the inventor claims.
Does anybody show a waveform of the 400 hertz output? I'm guessing it's very nonlinear. If that 400 hertz response of coil number 3 was put on an oscilloscope, is there any literature showing you what that waveform looks like? Wesley, go ahead.
There are various numbers of links over there, and there is also a explanation by the other guys. I just sent you that the first page on it. But what the inventor says is that they are playing with the isotope 56 of the soft iron that change to isotope 54. So what they say is that by introduction of 105 of EV, that would stand for field by volt. They changing the structure, and that the energy generated by this nuclear reaction inside the iron rod will produce an energy of gain of 20,000 EV. So I was talking about 1600. They claim 20,000. The energy required for generating this isotopic mutation is produced by nuclear magnetic resonance effect. The parametric excitation is obtained by the coil 2 acting as a pump.
KC2 QIQ with a comment here?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
See, the only thing that I don't know about this, and it was when I'm talking about ferrite, I'm talking about a material that's generally a loss material. Iron is generally a loss material. I'm very familiar with the chemical configurations of both those materials, and their isotopes, energy levels, are nothing near nuclear levels. We're talking about things with atomic levels, differences that are more than two orders of magnitude difference. Now, Wesley, what kind of material is this iron? Is this iron impregnated with some very, very heavy metals or something inside here with very, very high atomic counts? Because what I understand about iron and ferrite is there's nothing in there with atomic counts anywhere near nuclear levels. Let me pass that one back to you, Dick. Maybe I'm wrong here or way off chart, but that's the way at least I understand it. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let me respond to that.
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
The iron rod is used as the main source of the energy by isotopic mutation effect. This will provide the simple and cheap source of the energy for the long time. That's what the inventors claim. Now, whether they, as far as I know, the isotope 56 is a normal isotope. It's nothing special. It's not radioactive. There is nothing special about it. 56 is the most common isotope. Now, as far as the 54, it's another mutation to that. That means it's just that what they say is they are able to play with the subatomic structure by controlling the frequency. That's what I can say about it. I'm not the inventor. I didn't put it, but eventually if the patent office gave them the patent, means that there was something in it. It was examined. Although I might be wrong. go ahead.
Yeah, I'm reading the words of this patent, Glenn, and it says the inventors claim that if we introduce 105 EV, I presume that means electron volts, to the iron that had an isotope of 56, it is changed into iron isotope 54. My goodness, that sounds like transmutation. And you and I have heard of, at least in the past, the kind of hardware and enthusiasm, you know, nuclear reactor, you were talking about particle accelerators, what's required to transmute an isotope of one material into a brand new isotope, which really means you're making changes in the nucleus of the material. You can tell I'm starting off a bit skeptical that simply putting in complex signals can change the nucleus of isotope iron 56 into isotope iron 54. My goodness, that sounds difficult. What's your first impression on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
It's something I want to research, Dick. It sounds interesting to me. I have to agree with you that I can say is I'm dumbfounded. Everything that I know about iron and, I mean, stuff I work with every day, magnets, iron, ferrite, it's part of the business I'm in. I think I kind of understand that stuff pretty well. As a matter of fact, when I'm talking about changing isotopes to electromagnetic energy, something tells me that there's something else here that we don't know about. Obviously, if someone were to have a material that was impregnated with something radioactive inside of it, and that was already at a higher energy level, could you generate more energy by activating that higher energy material? I would say yes, of course. I believe that that's possible. Although, here again, I'm not the expert in that area. But here again, with just standard iron and standard ferrite, I've never witnessed or heard of anybody ever mention anything like that. So it's a little bit out of my field of knowledge here right now. I'm going to have to look into it.
Again, what they say is to generate all the energy by resonant nuclear ferromagnetism consisting the U-shaped chassis made of milled steel containing a cylindrical bar made of ferromagnetic fuel rod and with at least three induction coils act.
I think you just said something magic here. Fuel rod. Dick, what are you taking on that one? K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I think we might have just found the magic here.
The transition from French, you see that below that, this wording, I was just reading that.
Yeah, let me go back a step here, Glenn. When we get ferrite and other kinds of magnetic materials acting under the influence of a magnetic field, and you and I have read often talk about domains lining up when you do a permanent magnetization. And when you're lining up domains and you're talking about magnetic fields, it is my guess, it's my guess that the cloud of electrons around the nucleus of the magnetic materials are doing all of the work. That when you and I magnetize, permanently or non-permanently magnetize, magnetic materials, that the nucleus of the magnetic materials is left untouched, is my belief. I think magnetism has got something to do with the orientation of the axis of the electrons that are going around that nucleus. That what you and I call magnetization is primarily an electron effect, not a nucleus of the iron material effect. That's my guess. What's your feeling on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I completely agree, Dick, that the basically those materials are unchanged by magnetic fields. I mean, even if you go well beyond saturation, because saturation just basically means that when you accelerate even beyond, excite those materials beyond that level, it just means that the extra electromagnetic field is outside of the path length. And, you know, it's a growing field beyond the path length now, so it's because the material is saturated at some B-max. So but those materials intrinsically really aren't changing. But now, if there's another material, now I heard the word fuel rod being used here, which to me means something different. Now, if I have a material that's elevated to a very, very high nuclear level, and I impose an electromagnetic field around it, can I get additional amplification and energy from that fuel rod? I believe so. I believe the Russians have produced nuclear energy generators for years, where they use very, very small amounts of energy attaching to nuclear materials, and have generated power generators that are almost last a lifetime. And I know that they were becoming a nuisance, because when the USSR broke down, these little nuclear generators were winding up all along the ex-Soviet states, and people were worried that they would be contaminating when people would throw them out if they broke and nobody knew how to repair them. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Take one more thing. It says that the first coil is electromagnet. The second is nuclear magnetic resonance actuator. The third, recovering the induction energy present in the bar. Device intended particularly to supply commercially exploitable electrical energy as well as to perform isotopic mutations.
Okay. There's definitely the word nuclear magnetic resonance talked about here, talking about iron rod, but I've never seen in all of this write-up so far the word fuel rod. But,
Baron, look at the wording below, activator for isotopic mutation. In the rectangular, wording in the rectangle.
Yeah, okay. I see the word fuel rod in there. But backstepping one step. Even though I've got, okay, magnetic resonance imaging. Okay. It's called magnetic resonance imaging. Is anything changing in the nucleus of the materials that are undergoing magnetic resonance imaging? Your knowledge, Glenn, go ahead.
Not in standard materials, no. In other words, not in ferrite, not in iron, basic cobalt, the types of magnets that we're used to, those kinds of things. I don't know of anything changing by the field. I mean, the field will build to a point. As a matter of fact, that's what makes magnetic material what it is. It's stable to the levels of excitation. And generally, when you bring them outside the levels of excitation, the field just saturates to B-max. That's what makes them good ferrite materials. But here again, as I said, now if they were going to add a nuclear material within the path length or associated to the path length, can additional energy be generated from the nuclear material? Absolutely it can. Russians have done it for years. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If you can click on the link below the rectangle, it says HTTP J Nodin free this one. Then you're gonna be sent to another page. We'll explain you a little bit better.
What we now call magnetic resonance imaging (MRI) was a change because people really were getting upset about the word nuclear. It used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance. NMR became MRI. Nuclear magnetic resonance. When I was exposing a human being to a strong magnetic field and pulses of RF and making a three-dimensional image out of that, I'm old enough, can't think of the right word for holographic-like image. It was called magnetic resonance imaging. Magnetic resonance imaging is what it's called now.
nuclear magnetic resonance. Was that just a poor choice of words when it used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance? Was anything really happening in the nucleus of either the protoplasm or the machine itself? Was anything really happening in the nucleus in the early naming of that imaging technique? What do you think, Glenn?
It changes the spin of the hydrogen atom.
Yeah, can I add a couple of notes about this one?
When you say changes the spin, are you talking about what the electrons were doing or what the nucleus was doing, Eric?
Let me see if I can remember. I had learned about this. There's a certain resonant frequency. And what happens is the alignment of the protons. If it changes the alignment of the protons, then what you're really doing is you're changing the alignment of the nucleus.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Eric is right on with that. In other words, when you modulate basically these atoms, you can affect the direction of not only the path length of the material and the electron flow, but you can also, if the material is loosely organized like in a gas, you can arrange and shift the gas. So you can move things in position, not necessarily at the subatomic level, but at certain levels. So if you want to create an imaging, you can actually move things around it and either, you know, reflect it back and measure it and get an image, or in the other case, you can actually create images. So it's by taking gas and then form and move the gas with the electromagnetic field. So that goes in two directions. Now, nuclear means higher energy. Now, were there ever devices that used higher energy, in other words, using uranium and other rare isotope materials inside there to get an improved effect? I'm not sure, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Interesting. Dick, that link below gets you to the parametric pump, where there is explanation how this parametric pump works. That's done by another guy. It says HTTP, J, Nadine, free, and whatever. That's the below the rectangle. And you're going to see exactly the drawing and schematic of this pump.
In some of the readings I'm doing now to try to tell me what is happening at the atomic level of molecules, I've read that if I made a scale model of a hydrogen atom, and if I made the scale model as big as a football stadium, the proton that's in the center would be the size of an insect. So here's a simple hydrogen molecule as big as a stadium as far as its electron cloud is concerned, and the proton that's in the center is the size of an insect. Although Damatian, when he was inventing his machine way back in the early 60s, and he called the machine originally nuclear magnetic resonance, was he really affecting that nucleus, or was he just choosing words? I'm going to first ask Glenn and then Eric in that order. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, my understanding on that air is that he was not really moving anything within the nucleus. That's my feeling. I mean, you can change the direction of it, you can change everything, but it's not actually opening it or closing it or doing anything else, because, like, I think you and I both will agree on the amount of energy required to do that, even to very, very lightweight atoms like hydrogen, is extremely high, and the outside energy would have to be huge. So my feeling is, I'm agreeing with you, Dick, that when you were saying that it's just a naming thing, it's not necessarily what's going on at the actual nuclear level itself. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Eric, as I turn it over to you, when I subject magnetic or non-magnetic materials to a strong magnetic field, to be aligning the orbit of the electrons, I can accept that. Am I really doing something to the nucleus? Even aligning the nucleus, changing the nucleus and changing its isotope numbers, I'm having a lot of trouble with that. But am I even aligning the arrangement of the protons and neutrons of a nucleus when I have a strong local magnetic field? Does that magnetic field really get down to the nucleus and do something? Do KQLIW.
KQLIW, KQ. I'm really trying to strain my brain, trying to remember, because I had to learn some stuff about this. But what I did was I just pulled up Wikipedia on it. And what they say is, the physics of magnetic resonance imaging, the body is largely composed of water molecules. Each water molecule has two hydrogen nuclei, a proton. When a person goes inside a powerful magnetic field of the scanner, magnetic moments of these protons change and align to the direction of the field. And I'm trying to remember the resonant frequency. I think it's around 65 megahertz, and it takes quite a bit of energy. I don't remember what that number was, but it's quite a bit. An MRI machine, radio frequency transmitter, is briefly turned on, producing an electromagnetic field. Now, this gets me funny. The photons of this field have just the right energy known as the resonant frequency to flip the spin of aligned protons in the body. I'm going to raise it up.
Dick, I just sent you the explanation for this parametric pump.
As the intensity and duration of the application of field increases, the more aligned spins are affected. After the field is turned off, the protons decay to the original spin-down state, and the difference in energy between the two states is released as a photon. I don't get this. In these photons that produce the electromagnetic signal that the scanner detects. The frequency the protons resonate depends on the strength of the magnetic field, and it's all about the conservation of energy. Also dictates the frequency which releases the photons. There's a better explanation for this, but that's what they're saying. I have a paper on it somewhere. I have to find it.
Dick, I have to agree with that 100%, but that's not changing anything at the nuclear level. In other words, when that resonance is done, everything comes back to rest again. I mean, you take account of all of your protons there. You better have the same when you're done.
Yeah, transmuting a material is extremely difficult. I mean, the alchemists for hundreds of years have been trying to change lead into gold, for instance, and no way in hell. Now, is there a real change in the alignment of a nucleus of a hydrogen atom that's part of a water molecule that's inside of a human being in the case of this magnetic field and then relaxation? Are the protons of a hydrogen atom and their alignment, I'm not quite sure what the alignment of a proton means, but is the alignment of the protons, and are they spinning in that nucleus, is their alignment affected by magnetic field? In other words, the magnetic field is not only affecting the electrons, it's really affecting the protons that are in the nucleus of a hydrogen atom that's in the water that's inside of a human being. Is that what's going on here, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
K2RW, K2J. I'm still trying to remember. There is something about the spin axis of the protons. And it occurs in the molecule together. So it's not individual atoms, it's pairs of atoms. There's something about the alignment of them, whether they just tilt on the axis as a whole slightly. And we're talking about something that's very tiny. I'm with you on, are we really affecting the atom itself, or are we really just changing some form of kinetic energy because it's operating at this particular resonant frequency? Okay.
Yeah, something just occurred to me. A water molecule is highly polarized. The way water responds to RF energy in my microwave oven, it's got nothing to do with the frequency as the microwave oven operates at. The water molecule tries to flip back and forth at the RF carrier rate because it senses the E field of the RF carrier, and that water molecule is polarized. During the MRI imaging, is the polarization of the water molecule part of this relaxation that gives you the image. What do you think, Eric?
Well, I do know from seeing somebody line one of these things up, there's a very specific frequency in which it is able to get a response, and I think it's a 65 megahertz. If I can find it, I had a really nice paper that explained the whole thing. If I can find it, it really has a really good explanation. It's been a couple of years since I've read it, so I can't remember it exactly. We are talking about something that you're able to detect a change about. We're not talking about boiling water or, you know, giving a kinetic rotation to an entire water molecule. We are talking about something that is very specific to hydrogen.
And I think you're saying your memory of it is that the nucleus of the hydrogen and the way the protons in the nucleus rotate, that some form of alignment of the proton nucleus was taking place in that MRI machine. I know we're going over this over and over again. I'm trying to understand what's happening to the nucleus. Is it really the nucleus involved? Did Damadian, when he invented the machine, just come up with some fancy names, or was his name right on? What do you think, Eric?
KC2 QAQ with a comment?
Eric first, and then pass it over to Glenn.
Yeah, no, it definitely has something to do with either the spin or the alignment of the protons within the molecule as a pair. It is because of that change that you can detect something. I mean, as you well know in chemistry, you can actually take an electron and cause it to jump orbit. We're not talking about something like that, but we are talking about making some kind of reflective change within the molecule itself. Give it to Glenn.
You got a question?
My understanding of this, at least generally, when we're talking about, you know, a quantum model of basically, let's just talk about hydrogen because it's simple. And what's really happening here is that when you're talking about the proton is a balance between the electron and the energy state around the outside with respect to the proton and, of course, the other atoms of hydrogen next to it and how they relate to each other in terms of energy levels. So now if you apply an outside force to it, yes, those electron fields and valence levels are going to align accordingly. And if there's frequencies associated to it, it will change. But the effect is still going to be the same over a variety of frequencies. But I think where the MRI machine is really getting its, where the resonance is really required is because of the sensor that's measuring the difference. So because it is a system where you have to send some kind of a signal out, but you also have to receive it to get the image. So the frequency is probably more important to the receptor sensor than it is to actually making this effect take place. But actually, how do you define the proton of an atomic model? In other words, and give it a direction. Its direction is directly related to its valence energy around the outside, which is its electrons. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, I see a proton, I might be awfully naive here, I see a proton as a point source of charge, 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, of positive charge as a electrostatic object. Maybe I'm too simplistic here. And the MRI machine does some kind of a pulse of energy of around 65 megacycles. I presume there's some kind of a ring down time. And the magnitude and the duration of the ring down time, is that what's being imaged, Eric, from your understanding?
Yeah, I can remember something, a word that there's a spin relaxation time, which is one aspect of it, and then there's also another word that they use, which is a spin echo. Let me look through this. A weighted scan uses a gradient echo, and it gives a set of times. It doesn't really explain it very clearly, but yeah. Spin density, also called proton density. Weighted scan, try to have no contrast, and from one period to the next period decay. Only signal change coming from the differences in the amount of available spin. It's not clear, but I think that's what we're really talking about.
Did you have any comments?
I got a quick question for Glenn. Glenn, you work with magnetic materials. You work with non-magnetic materials. What's different at the molecular level of a material that you and I call magnetic and you and I call the material that we say is non-magnetic? I know there's a couple of different kinds of non-magnetic, but what's really different to make one material magnetic and another one non-magnetic at the molecular level? Over to you, Glenn.
Paramagnetic and diamagnetic.
Well, if you look at the properties of ferrite and iron, and you look, first of all, they're conductors, right? They have to have a conductive property, which that you wouldn't have in a dielectric material. The other thing is that you have to have a certain amount of free valence electrons, a certain amount that will allow not necessarily the greatest conductivity, but the amount of free valence energy for alignment. So you need some spacing between the electrons. When you've got materials like copper and aluminum, you got a very, very tight atomic count that keeps the electrons very, very tightly knit. In ferrite and iron, you've got a spacing between the valence shells, which are very, very wide. So now when you apply an electromagnetic field to things that are electron valence shells that are very, very wide apart at their atomic level, the magnetic field around them is very uniform. That's a very simplistic explanation, Dick, but I can probably go in more detail. Let me see if you follow that so far.
And also, I just ran across this, the normal photon resonance frequency of 63 megahertz is 1.5 teslas.
So there's something about the nucleus that has some form of resonance phenomena, is what you seem to be saying, Eric. And Glenn, what you're talking about right now seems to be only describing the valence shells of the electrons on magnetic materials, on magnetic and ferromagnetic and diamagnetic, on all of these various kinds of magnetic materials. Is the real difference the valence shells of the electrons, or is the nucleus itself somehow involved in the magnetic process? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, of course, the nuclear chemical count is what's going to determine what the material is. So from that standpoint, yes, by its definition. But it's actually the valence energy shells. In other words, as I said, if they're too closely knit, like in copper, what's going to happen is that the magnetic field isn't going to build as easily, so the permeability is going to be low, just like as if it was in open air. Now, if you get a very, very nice sweet spot, like with ferrites and irons, where the valence shells are at nicely fixed levels, where they're resistive enough between each other so that they don't bang into each other, but there's enough valence count to be basically positioned, they perform better to magnetic materials. So generally, if you look at magnetic materials and you look at their energy counts, they're typically listed by their levels. And, of course, the other problem is you're selecting them also not only for the spacing of the valence shells, but it's also because of loss and hysteresis. So when you get the ones that are very, very wide apart, you're going to have lower permeabilities, but what will happen is you have lower high-frequency loss.
Okay, with that philosophy in mind, what is magic about neodymium that allows it to create such extremely strong magnetic fields?
It's that it's a well-defined dipole.
Okay, yeah. Eric, I think you've got some comments on this, and then pass it over to Wesley. Eric, first.
Sorry, I wasn't listening. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay. Interaction for ID. That second image that they sent you just so you can open up, there are three schematics of how the parametric pump works. There's three coils. Actually, the first drawing on the top, on the left-hand side, shows you two horizontal coils connected in series. They are named L1 and L2, but actually it's one coil. So that would be the first coil that is fitted by the generator. Now, then vertically, you have that ferrite and two coils on that ferrite. And then on the top and on the bottom, you have that horseshoe U-shape soft iron metal. That's the first way. And this guy is not the guy who patented that. This is the guy who was doing the investigation now. That drawing, that picture that shows the cone vibrating on the right hand side is just graphic explanation of that excitation that takes place. Do you see that, Dick and Dr. J?
Okay, I see the picture called the TEP Project V8 Parametric Pump. That's the first picture. The next picture has the same label. Then there is a three-dimensional drawing.
And the drawing is just showing the excitation. That's what is vibrating in the middle, is that excitation that takes place. There were three approaches, and then all of the math correlated to that. That was done by another guy. That is, the name is Jay Nodden.
Okay, that blue background picture, Jay Nodden, 1997, where there is a cone in the center of those two red cylinders on above and below, and the green cylinders left and right. Is that cone representing a precessing object? Is that what you're saying?
No. That cone only represents excitation that takes place for you to graphically understand what's going on. And when you see the green left and right, then you see, you look at the schematic, the first schematic, and do you see a coil L1 and L2? So both of the horizontal green figures are representing coil L1 and L2, but because they are in series, we say that this is the first coil that is fed by the generator. Now, on the top, you see two red, and these two red, they are coil L3 and L4. And then, on the top of these two red vertical, you see that a horseshoe U-shape. Back to you.
Above L3 and below L4 are the fixed magnets, which I think you're saying are in a U-shape. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, these magnets, they're not the magnets. If you look at the picture with the vibrating object, all the way to the top and all the way to the bottom, you have the ends of that U-shape.
And the very center material called B-A, F-E, F-E is iron, but what does the B-A stand for? Is that
ferrite. In other words, is on that picture with that vibrating object, they didn't put specially the ferrite to not have this not readable, but we can say that between this the red on the top and red at the bottom, which red represents coil L3 and L4, there is a ferrite. And that's what actually is showing us a vibrating object, is that excitation.
Is the chemical symbol for ferrite BAFE?
No idea.
It's one of them, Dick.
What does the BA stand for in BAFE, Glenn?
I'm not sure. I know that there's a whole bunch of characteristics of them and where they're listed, and because most of these ferrite materials are all based on iron, and what they do is they have binder materials that bind them in different with glues and pressure and temperature, and I believe it's got to do with the binding process, Dick.
In the periodic table, is Ba barium?
I don't believe that is, in other words, these are like produced materials. There was, like, if you look at like charts for ferrites, unlike standard iron, iron has a very specific chemical number, okay, right? And it's very well understood. When you're talking about ferrite, these are produced materials. They're ground up ferrite, and there's binders, and then they're pressed. So you kind of see what I'm saying? It's kind of like a composite material.
Okay. Someone mentioned earlier that the actual ferrite particles are ferric oxide to make them non-conductive, so you can make them small, close to each other, but not conduct to each other, and you put them into some kind of a binding. The raw material itself, is it just grind finer in order to make a higher frequency ferrite, or is the real chemical composition different, Glenn?
So zinc.
The basic ferrites are ground up iron with binders, and there are other oxides associated with them, yes. And they have to be frozen so that they don't deteriorate and rust. So a lot of these mixes are kept very, very close to the manufacturers. They don't like to let out how they make these mixes. But they're not the only ones. For lower frequencies, you can use nickel, you can use manganese, you can use aluminum. They use a whole bunch of different materials, and they suspend them in the binders. And that's why you get these funny numbers and names for them. But they're basically numbers of compounds, not specific to the atomic chart of exactly what they are.
Aluminum is a non-magnetic material. Why would I add aluminum particles to the ferrite mix, Glenn?
I got news for you. Aluminum oxide is. You can have decaying aluminum inside a binder, and it's a magnetic material, Dick, especially when it's suspended at a specific grain.
So you're not talking about eddy currents here. You're talking about real magnetic properties of aluminum. Can I make a permanent magnet out of aluminum?
In a solid piece, not a very good one. Keep in mind, do we have a couple minutes here, or has everybody got to go to bed? Because I can talk about this a little bit.
Give us some words, because I'm really ignorant in this area.
Let's talk about dipole of charge for a minute. A dipole, and if you're looking at a capacitor and you have charge, you know, Q is equal to CV, and you basically have a dipolar element here that's got charge in it, in energy. It's fixed potential energy. And we call that a capacitor. Right? It's got a plus side and a minus side. Now, if you have something with charge with a low impedance, okay, in other words, basically like shorted out impedance, but it still has charge in it, that's a magnet. Do you follow me so far on this one?
I'm having a little trouble with this one. When you talk about charge on a capacitor, we're talking about electrostatic field. And the jump between electrostatic and magnetic, I haven't made that transition yet. Go ahead.
Okay, if you look at electron volts, EV, and VH curve, basically what happens when you look at a capacitor and you're going to draw a capacitor, you do realize that there is, even though that it's got an EV at a certain point, there is an H associated to it, but it's a very, very small H. Do you follow?
I could be creating an H while I'm pouring current into the lead of the capacitor, but you're telling me there is a magnetic field taking place within somewhere of the structure of a, let's say, electrolytic capacitor. Go ahead.
Right on. And when you basically draw this on a BH curve, what happens is you wind up with a 1 point up on the vertical scale. You follow?
A BH curve, I'm putting ampere turns in, that's horizontal, and I'm getting a certain H field response, that's the vertical. And I plot that hysteresis plot, and now I'm talking about the magnetic properties of a core or some other kind of material. Are you telling me that if I charge, if I plot voltage horizontal and Q vertical, I'm not going to get a slanted straight line on a normal linear capacitor?
Not until you pull current out of it.
Hold on now. If I put 1 ampere into a capacitor for 1 second, haven't I stored 1 coulomb of charge? So if I'm talking about voltage horizontal, and there's also voltage in time, current. Okay. Would a capacitor, if I'm plotting charge versus voltage on a capacitor, would there be a hysteresis curve to that?
That's the resistor, the R.
Couldn't I have a horizontal axis where I'm applying voltage to a capacitor and a vertical axis representing the amount of stored charge on the capacitor? when I make that graph, wouldn't that be a 45-degree line if I choose the units correct on the horizontal and vertical axis?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm having trouble leaping from there into magnetic fields.
Okay, because what's happening is in between, you have to have a steady state alignment of your charge. In other words, when you're looking at charge over a distance, whether it's your dielectric material, there has to be an H related to build up the charge.
Okay, so my dielectric materials, if I'm looking at them with a super good microscope at the molecular level, in order to build up an E field in my dielectric material, I think you're telling me the orbits of the electrons are being disturbed in such a way that it represents stored energy. Is that true?
That's correct. Right on.
And you're saying that there's a small magnetic field created within the capacitor as I store electrostatic energy in that dielectric material. Is what I think you're saying.
That's absolutely correct. And not only that, what you're basically realizing, just like I'm alluding to right now, is that there's a loss associated to it. That charge isn't going to last forever now, is it? You can make it really minimum, but there has to be some leakage there, right?
Well, in the case of flash memories, that electrostatic charge is stored for an awful long period of time.
Agreed, but you do realize that there is a loss there.
I owned a nuclear detecting device, which really was an extremely small capacitor, and it would store hundreds of volts of charge on a fraction of a picofarad capacitor for weeks. That's a leak down rate that was probably 10 to the 18 ohms, something like that. Go ahead.
Right on, but you have to realize that there is still a leakage there. It still has to be some H, because if you didn't have something, some dielectric, to build that charge across, you could not have that charge.
Hey, you know, we use glass capacitors for Savon holes, so they don't leak off too fast.
What's the longest you've ever heard of a charge being stored on some kind of electrostatic device? My best example is either that nuclear detector I just mentioned, or a flash memory. A flash memory stores charge for years, doesn't it? Go ahead.
Now, I've never dealt with long-term charge in the capacitor. The reason why we use glass capacitors and a lot of different devices is to accurately hang on to that charge for a period of time that, you know, can be seconds or minutes, but I've never dealt with anything longer than that. Oh, by the way, if you get a chance, do a Google search for Lamor frequency, L-A-R-M-O-R frequency, and read that. That'll give you some clues as to how the water molecules are affected in MRI.
Can we go back to the magnet for a second now?
Yeah, I'm still really lost on magnets, but go ahead.
So as far as the charge on the capacitor, that's pretty well understood. You realize there's got to be a dielectric in between, and of course there's some magnetic minuscule in between just in order to produce, so that you could have that charge available. Because without it, the charge wouldn't exist. But now on the other end of the scale, you can have an area where you have a dipole again. This time, what's happening is you've got a magnet dipole. And what's actually happening is you have charge across the dielectric, but now it's like a theoretical short. In other words, what's happening is you have the energy stored in the dipole. In other words, the material is still aligning plus to minus. But what's actually happening now is the impedance is extremely low. Now, if you look at the circulating field inside there, there's an internal circulating current within that material associated to that dipole that's basically shorted out. So if you try to measure, if you take a voltmeter and try to measure the voltage across a magnet, you'll measure zero voltage. But there's a current always flowing within it, almost like the theoretical inductor where the current is always flowing.
In the case of a ring of superconducting material, I can set up a current that stays there forever. Are you telling me there's a whole bunch of little rings of current continuously flowing as if you had superconductivity inside of a permanent magnet material, and that's what's generating the magnetic field. Is that what you're saying, Glenn?
Got 2 minutes, so I think that's all.
At the atomic level, that's correct, Dick.
Wow. I got to think about that. I'm also looking at Wikipedia, Lamor frequency here, and I'm looking at the precession, Lamor precession. I got to leave you guys. My son's waiting to talk to me before he leaves, and I got to get up early tomorrow. We got a long way to go. K2RIW, TechNet, Limark, TechNet number 1318. Bye-bye, you all. Someday we're going to understand some of the jazz.
Hey, 73's everybody. Have a good one. 73's Dick, Eric, Wesley, whoever else is listening. KC2QIQ.
Good night to all, K2J. By the way, Ferrite has a cubic crystalline structure. We can get into that another time.
Good night, Mel. Mel, are you able to stay up this late? Are they allowing you up this late in Brooklyn?
And I got a million things to do tomorrow. Yeah, I'm only going to get into this business with Ferrite. They've got, oh boy, they got some crazy mixes. And also, I know somebody was very involved with it, and there's a whole tremendous story about it. Okay, with that, good night, everybody. And I'll get into some other time. We'll get into MRI machines. I've been inside of them, so, okay, pick it up another time. Good night. Have a great week. 73 is all.
Hey, Mel, listen to the input frequency once in a while.
Mel, are you saying you've got some friends that really know about ferrites and magnetic fields and they've given you some understanding of all this jazz?
At one time, yes. Bob and L, what a heck it was. I don't recall it all, Dick, but it was a complicated business over.
To prepare for WRC-12, a true worldwide ham license could be on its way. South Africa and Indonesia to launch a pair of handsets in 2011. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1730, coming your way right now from around the world.